And this thing is it a digital tape or?
It's DV, yes.
God, that's amazing.
So this one is not. It's not pure broadcast quality, but it's good enough.
That's really fascinating.
It's funny.
Someday this will be right in the middle of your forehead, the little third eye, which, like the chap in MIT who's running around with a camera on his head.
There's a new version of this, which we're going to get when we do the final work. It looks exactly like this. It looks like it, you know, not a professional camera. It's got three chips. It's exactly the same as it would see for
broadcasting. It really is.
And it's unobtrusive.
This is a good example of what happens when you get cost and size and so on. To a certain point, suddenly it becomes usable in circumstances that it would, you know, it just wouldn't consider doing any videotaping at all. Yep. Zero, no way. So it's pretty impressive. So let's see, what would I want to see? I'd certainly want to know about the man. I'd like to know more about what makes somebody like this tick. You can't start out that way too well without at least giving some idea of why it's important to know why this guy ticks or why it's interesting to know. So clearly you have to start out by giving some sense for what it is that why would you even bother making a documentary about that?
What do you think we should bother? We have so many different perspectives on that one.
I'm sorry, what do you think Doug's legacy is?
Yeah, what do you think we should make a documentary about that?
Let's see. If I were doing this, and again, I haven't given this a lot of thought, so it's worth, 30 milliseconds or whatever. It's free, right? That means it's worth about that much. I imagine starting out saying, what's it like to see 30 years ahead of your time? And the answer, in part, is a tremendous challenge because no one can see what you're seeing. Because it's so far ahead that it's around the corner and many, many miles away. And so they don't understand.
But you must have some knowledge of that perspective. I mean, look at your own career.
I wouldn't claim to have seen as far as Doug. I'm not to lose track now of this documentary, but no, it's okay. I mean, my work has been much more concrete. A problem was posed and a solution was found, and it had implications that we didn't necessarily fully appreciate, but we kept working the problem. And then we built it, and then we got other people involved in it, and it just kept growing. The basic architecture is still in place, but the scope is, phenomenally bigger.
Yeah.
But that's been an evolution. And I think in many ways, Doug's thinking was more complete in some sense. I mean, the implications of his ideas were in his own head anyway, I think, were far more complete about things you could possibly do if you were to design and build an information infrastructure that helped knowledge workers do their work. It helped augment the way in which we think and deal with information. So I'm imagining that this thing starts out by giving us some immediate sense for why this man is interesting, because of what he saw 30 years before. And of course then the question is, well, what did he see? And how do you represent that? And Doug would probably object, and maybe Tim would object, to representing the World Wide Web as what Doug saw. And it's not what he built, but I think it was very much in the spirit of what he saw. I don't know that he fully thought about what it would be like if there could be hundreds of millions of machines all interacting with each other, and that wasn't feasible in the days when he was building things on $6 million computers. None of us foresaw any of that, because I don't think anyone, except maybe the guys at Xerox PARC, saw the possibility of personal computing and built them in 1972, 20 to 30 years before, well, 20 years anyway, before PCs were really feasible. Then they spent $50,000 per machine, and no one in his right mind would spend that unless you were truly trying to explore the future, which part reasonably was trying to do. But I would be inclined to kind of show the web as a representative of what Doug saw was possible. And the reason I think Doug might object and Tim might object is that, the web is actually weak compared to what Doug saw. And functionally what he did in the NLS was a lot more rich than what we can do today, although we're getting pretty close to some of the things that Doug is doing. The media aspect, I think, is emerging. We're clearly, we're treating all kinds of media as digital forms that can be passed around. But some of the other, the manipulations that we could do with the text in the NLS system and our ability to abstract information, to move blocks and things around, are nowhere present in certainly nothing in Microsoft Word or any of the other word processing systems comes close to the conceptual richness of the manipulative abilities. Of course, on the other hand, the commands were unbelievably cryptic, right?
No,
five-finger keyboard.
No.
You don't think so?
No, it's
this is another one of those habituation things. I mean, once you get the commands down, you can do them with your left hand.
He has this one magic key, though.
Yeah.
The question mark key. Because anytime you're it's not like DOS where you...
Oh, you would say question, it would give you a list of possible things.
It's a complete syntax. So you would say, maybe, you know, open this in a new window with this view, blah, blah, blah. And if O stands for outline, for instance, as a view mode,
mm-hmm.
When you type in O, it shows the whole word,
mm-hmm.
O,
yeah.
Outline.
Oh, this is the command completion.
Yeah,
right.
And then if you know, like with the question mark, it shows you, like you said, all the different options. Mm-hmm. It's a lot easier than any Unix or DOS I've ever seen. But it wasn't sold very well.
All right.
Fair enough.
I mean, we could argue over this. I mean, we all got used to it eventually. You know, it's just that it was the two-letter commands and the... And you know, left-hand keyboard, it's funny, isn't it, that the five-finger keyboard never really took off, but the mouse did. You know? Mm-hmm. There were three buttons on the original mouse, if I remember right. And that's yet another.
There was three
buttons. Well, not that mouse, but...
How many was that, two?
One.
One?
Was there only one in the first one?
No, that was the first.
Oh, okay. I seem to remember it proliferated for a while. I thought the Apple guys got it right. I'm not really a big fan of multiple buttons, but then you know, then you have ambiguity.
Left click. What does that mean?
What does it do? Yeah, and I've got three buttons on the ThinkPad, and I've never been able to figure out what the blue button does. It doesn't seem to do anything. You know, the screen blinks and then nothing happens. It's like one of those adventure games, you know, where you say, open the sack and nothing happens.
Yes.
It's, you forgot to put the orange smoke in the whatever.
Yes.
So we have to get some sense for what it was that saw. The problem with trying to show them NLS is that no one's familiar with it who would be seeing this program, so they wouldn't really understand. I can remember watching Doug from behind once, and there was a screen sitting here, and Doug's got the keyboard and the mouse and the foot pedal going. And the screen is going like crazy, and he's talking, right? And from behind, he looks motionless.
Right.
And so making these minute motions with his hands, and the screen is going nuts. And you know, I remember thinking that this is really bizarre. You know, I mean, what's going on? Of course, once you sat down and you realized what commands he was executing, it all made sense. But it looked very funny, especially with that keyboard, because you barely see anything happening, and the commands would be executed.
It's like dancing, but you know, with only like you know the extremities of your body. You know.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. So. It's like river dance, right? You know, where the top half is doing nothing and the bottom half is going crazy.
I'll delete that one. NLS is like river dance. Yeah, that's great. Accurate, but not quite.
So somehow we would have to quickly capture a sense for what it was that Doug saw, which makes him interesting, especially if we could see the difference between this giant $6 million computer that had flashing lights all over the place and you know, a laptop or a PDA.
Yeah.
And so realizing that there's this 30-year gap also gives people a sense for what can happen in a 30-year period. This is also something that none of us is very good at projecting. The technology over that long a period of time can really, really change a lot.
Yeah. That's where we see you coming in very strongly, because if you build something over here and someone builds something over here before the networks are universal, you know, you can't really do anything. But like, I make a living selling stuff on the internet. It's a little product that lives on the fact that the internet protocols are there, the email protocols are there. That means doesn't matter what the rest of your world is, we can plug it in. So many of Doug's ideas can do the same thing. They can plug in because there's an infrastructure. We've never had a digital infrastructure.
No, we haven't. And it's still very primitive. I mean, what's interesting about it, it's very layered.
Yeah.
And now this is something I never talked to Doug about, so I don't know whether he thinks that way. I know I do. I think in terms of layers. And every time you create another layer, you create another uniformity. And when you create uniformity, you create a platform on top of which you can build some more stuff.
Yep.
And so the more people you can draw into that layer of uniformity, the more opportunity there is to try some new ideas out that otherwise wouldn't work.
Yep.
And the part that I find the most intriguing about the layering structure is that in the case of internet, what you get when you get internet service is all of the layers, including the lowest one, which means if you want to, you can build your own set of protocols at any point in the staircase of layering. So you can kind of come to whatever landing you need to, and then you get to build your own.
Yep.
And that means that any creative idea that happens to come along is fair game. Yep. They don't have to get permission from the guy supplying the internet service to add a new layer on top of IP,
yep,
or on top of TCP, or on top of HTTP, or on top of SOAP, or on top of PPP, or whatever you want to, you know, choose.
Absolutely.
So that's an enabling function.
Is there an analogy to that anywhere else in human experience? I was completely new.
Let's see. Well, no, it's not in that sense.
Okay.
We've had similar experiences. Electricity is an example of that. You know, once we had power generation and distribution, and we had the ability to plug into the wall, that meant power was available. Now you could design and build products that assume power is available. Telephone system, same thing. Waterways, before the railroad, same thing. If you had waterways, you had canals and so on.
The railroads, things, another one. Not in such a short time span.
Or with such many layers.
I
mean, Robert Kelly, the other web guy.
That's fair. That's fair that the multiple layers were not realizable in the other. They're mostly kind of one layer things like roads. Although even there, we're now starting to see multiple layers where you actually have roads on top of roads, where you have elevated highways. It's fascinating when you think about it. An elevated highway lets you get more space for the transportation system in a place where you couldn't have gotten any before, by literally building new space in the same horizontal dimension. But that's a very good observation. I hadn't thought about it in those terms. Layering is only possible because of the fact that we're using computers to do this. It's a virtual layering that's going on. But I do think that there have been a fairly large number of examples of standardization of widespread scope, which once it has been done, you have the opportunity to do quite a bit of creative things. So that's like roads. Once you have definitions for how wide is a road and how fast can you go on it, you can build an infinitely large number of vehicles of all kinds of ones they need. So there's the container ship is an example of a kind of a multi-layer design.
Yeah.
In fact, it's almost literally an analog of the way internet works because the container ship. Well, yes, they're very large packets, but basically it's the same concept.
Yep.
I mean, you pull them off the boat and you pop them onto the back of a tractor trailer. Mm-hmm.